when someone urges you to be careful, how careful do you need to be? That would depend entirely on what they're asking you to be careful about. Someone says, thanks for helping me with the groceries. Careful of this bag, there's eggs in it. How careful you should be? Well, you know, a carton of eggs, a couple bucks. You drop that thing, you're going to have to go back to the store for more eggs. You've got a mess on your hands. You should be fairly careful. If someone says, look at this, the newborn baby, home from the hospital, careful. Then you'll be more careful than a dozen eggs because there's more at stake, right? Something more valuable, something more horrible would happen if you're not careful. What about you dropping in your buddy and he says, hey, I got a new hobby. I build landmines. Here, look at this one. Careful. You want to be more careful in a different way because, you know, an accident with a landmine could be a real disaster. Our text this morning is Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. It's a call to be careful. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. The verse is printed on the top of the outline on the back of your bulletin. And here's what we are to be careful with. You tell me how careful we should be. Paul the Apostle says, therefore, be careful how you walk. Not as unwise men, but as wise. Be careful how you walk. Now, this is one of six times in Paul's letter to the Ephesians that he uses the W word. He says, walk. You would know that if you have, like me, a New American Standard Bible in front of you. One of the reasons I like the New American Standard Bible, which is not all that easy to find anymore in a Christian bookstore, is not all that popular version. One of the reasons I like it is that if Paul the Apostle uses the Greek word that means walk, it shows up in the English translation as the word walk. Some modern translations, understanding what he means, do your work for you, and it comes out as the word live. So then the verse would be careful how you live, not as unwise men, but as wise. That's no doubt a fair translation of the meaning of his words. But I like to do my own work, and it's good for us to know. He's talking about life as compared to a walk. You can fill in a blank here. Those six places where the word walk is mentioned, including our text this morning, means walk metaphorically. Walk equals live one step at a time. You get the notion when you talk about living as walking that our lives are comprised, when all is said and done, of a whole lot of little steps. You take one step at a time, and that constitutes your walk. And I want us to think this morning about how important it is to be careful and how careful we should be on this topic of how we live, how we walk one step at a time through this life. There are two reasons why this is a particularly timely topic in my mind, from my perspective. One is that it's September. It's the new beginning of another ministry year. Some of you who have not been involved in some regular ministries through the summer are looking forward to getting back in the swing of things or have just gotten back into the swing of things. And as we start this new beginning, as we see the opportunities to serve God before us, I think we'll all agree it's good to be careful. We've got some opportunities to serve God. We've got some opportunities to accomplish some things. Let's not blow it here. Let's not be careless and so bring to nothing what could be something. It's the beginning of a whole new year in terms of how we set up church ministry, at least, so we ought to be careful. The other reason why the idea of being careful how we live is of great interest to me today is that today is my birthday. And I've been thinking about the fact that every year that I live, I'm a year older. Now, don't go on and on about it. I've had a birthday now 49 times in a row. And there's nothing particularly noteworthy about turning 49, except for this one thing. I haven't yet turned 50. And I do have now, starting for the next 365 days or so, the opportunity to get ready for that notable birthday. And I just know that if I'm alive a year from now, I will be hearing all kinds of people say all sorts of helpful and encouraging things using phrases like the big 5-0 and half a century and your sixth decade. And there'll be all kinds of notice taken, perhaps, of the fact that I'm by no means a young guy anymore. And that makes me realize how important it is to walk, that is, to live carefully. Here's a personal conviction and some blanks to fill in. Every year I live, it becomes more and more important to be careful how I walk, because with every passing year, I am, one, less and less able to plead immaturity. I'm less and less able, the older I get, to plead immaturity. You know, when I was a teenager, I thought 30 was really old. Just as I turned 30, I had started work here at the church. I came at the ripe old age of 29, and 3 weeks later I turned 30, and it suddenly didn't seem very old to me. In fact, I think I expected that church family back in 1984 to cut me a fair degree of slack just because I was so crazy young. for the position. I thought if I say some stupid things this year, if I make some bad calls, if I blunder with some bad decisions, well, people will forgive me. I'm really quite young. 30 seemed young when I was there. In actual fact, when I turned 40, 40 seemed kind of young. But I remember being 15 years old and writing a birthday poem for my mother on the occasion of her 40th birthday. And I know what I was thinking. I was feeling sorry for the old girl. She was getting so old. I thought, you know, give her a little something to live for in her declining years. She's 40. And then I got to be 40 and it didn't seem very old at all. And now 50's not feeling very old, but it sounds old. I remember my dad being 50, and boy, I had feelings of sympathy for him as well. And less so can I say in regard to blunders I make, bad calls that I get involved in, foolish action or regrettable words, well, give me a break, I'm still quite young. 50 or practically 50 is not quite young by any definition, and I'm less and less able to say that that's an excuse for bad behavior. Besides that, every year I live, it becomes more and more important to be careful how I walk, because with every passing year, I am, number two, more and more obligated to say, this is my life. I'm not able to project into the future some, you know, other state of being in which that will be the real me, and this is me just getting there. I mean, it's apparent that I did not die young. I got to full age. And the amount of wisdom with which I am wise is, all else being equal, how wise I ever got. And the degree to which I am a kind and loving man has to be taken as the more or less level to which I rose in terms of kindness and loving kindness. I can't imagine that this doesn't count as the life that I'm living. This is the life that I'm living. Whatever degree of integrity I operate at is the real me. And I can't pretend that later on I will become the person that I'll be remembered by as. This is the person that I am. So looking at the call in Ephesians chapter 5 to be careful how we walk, I'd like to present to you three challenges from the book of Ephesians, all coming from this metaphor of life as a walk. And with it, three keys I have learned that I want to publicly commit myself to continuing to act upon as the keys to succeeding in these challenges. All right? So let's look together, and notes to fill on the sermon outline if this would be a helpful way for you to remember where we've been this morning. Three challenges and then three keys to success. And I'd like to give out these challenges in reverse order, the way they announced the winner of the Miss America Beauty Pageant, right? First you get the second runner-up, and then there's only two left. And as a funny thing, they announced the first runner-up, which everybody promptly ignores because the one that's not mentioned is the winner. And so I'll do number three, and then I'll do number two, and then I'll do the one challenge, the great challenge, which confronts anyone who in my position is realizing this is the life I live, and I better take it seriously, and I better live it carefully. So here's the third challenge that we'll look at first. Challenge number three, the challenge to accomplish something. It's what Paul the Apostle talked about when he first mentioned walking in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10. We saw this last week. He said, we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. God has in mind for us to live a life which we experience step by step, encountering the good works which have been prepared beforehand for us and being prepared for them as God's workmanship. He means for us, God calls us, to live a life in which we actually accomplish something. And I think this idea of accomplishment and productivity is largely what Paul has in mind in our text, verse 15, when he says, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, because he goes on to complete the sentence, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. Which is to say, the days being what they are, evil being so prevalent in the world, you've got to really work at making the most of your opportunities, or your opportunities will fall flat and you will not have accomplished that which you have been prepared to accomplish. You won't successfully do the good works which have been prepared beforehand for you to walk in. That is, a productive and a productive life full of accomplishments is not a natural thing. It's a supernatural thing. It's an unnatural thing. We need to be careful and diligent in order to make it happen. Paul the Apostle explains that there's a way of living life which is like building out of gold and silver and precious stones. And there's a way of living life, he says this in 1 Corinthians 2, which is like building out of wood and hay and straw. And when you've finished living your life and you've added to your life all the component parts, then on the day of judgment, when we stand before our Maker and Redeemer, a great fire will be put to the work of our lives so that the gold and the silver and the precious stones will be refined. But the wood and the hay and the straw will not survive. And Paul the Apostle says that there are people who are genuinely saved who will be saved as through fire. They will be like people who get up in the middle of the night and wearing their house coats and their bedroom slippers stand in the front yard while their whole house burns in front of them. And they are saved, but as through fire. They are saved with nothing to show for their lives. And my commitment must be, in regard to the challenge to accomplish something, that I find what I'm living for and I live for it and accomplish things that I can leave behind as the mark of my life. I was deeply influenced in this direction as a first-year university student involved with an organization called the Navigators at University of Guelph. And the Navigator staff person was a Jamaican by birth who had been educated in Jamaica and planned a business life in Jamaica. He took business courses and then he went to look for work. And he sat down with a HR guy in the office of a huge banana business, grew bananas and shipped them all over the world. And this man was looking for young fellows who would give themselves to the business, and actually said to this man I got to meet, actually said, what we're looking for is a young man who will give his life to bananas. And that was the point at his life when he decided to live for greater things than that. And there I was at 18 years old in university thinking, funny story, but what am I living for? And at the time, I really wanted to be a veterinarian, and I thought, I'm living for cats and dogs. And then I realized, no, I only want to be a veterinarian because I think they make lots of money, and they'll have time and money to ski. And I'm living for sliding down a hill with things on my feet. And it suddenly occurred to me at that age that I need to be careful what I live for. A young man who was also impacted with the idea of living for something worthwhile and accomplishing something with his life is Jim Elliot, who died as a missionary at the age of 29 in Ecuador. And in a copy of a book he left behind, which his wife found as she was writing his journal, she found this statement written by Somerset Maugham in the novel Of Human Bondage. I don't know the context, but here's a statement, and Jim Elliot wrote something in the margin beside it. The author said, "These old folk had done nothing, and when they died, it would be just as if they had never been." Just as if they had never been when they died. They had done nothing with their lives. And Jim Elliot wrote in the margin, "God deliver me." Well, he didn't live long, but he lived productively. He accomplished things. When he died, his life obviously had added up to something, though it was a short life. And it's more incumbent upon me than upon him to accomplish something with my life because I've been given many more years than he was given. I have the notion, you know, I have this idea of people deciding what to write on my tombstone. And let's say I live to be 76 years old. So we got the numbers worked out. And it will say, Michael G. Wilkins, born 1954, died 2030. Whatever. What will people write on my tombstone? What will they write on yours? If they try to summarize what your life amounted to, what you accomplished, would they know what to write? Just don't want to live a life that people don't know how to summarize because it didn't seem to mean anything. I got this notion of living the way I'm living, and when all is said and done and people are, you know, standing around at the reception following my funeral, they say, well, you know, interesting guy. He wore out a lot of running shoes. Around and around and around he ran. And boy, did he paddle that canoe a lot. Every summer he was paddling his canoe. Interesting life. I know I need my life to accomplish something, to add up to more than just some nice canoeing experiences and some long runs in the country, as much as that's a great experience for me. I need to build out of gold and silver and precious stones. So what's the key? What's one thing I can incorporate into my life to help me succeed in the challenge of accomplishing something and getting into the fulfillment of those good works which God has prepared beforehand for me to walk in? How can I be careful how I walk, not as an unwise man, but as a wise man? Well, one key, you can put it down in the blank, is teamwork. Teamwork. It's implied. We saw this last week in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, where Paul says, we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works which God has prepared that we should walk in them. And the notion is that we as individual parts of a body are like one person. Christ is the head, and we all together doing our various with our various abilities and various gifts, working together, accomplish the work that this one man, this body, can accomplish. We need to work together. You know, we have this big event as an illustration called Oktoberfest, our idea of putting on some fun for the community just to get people's attention and warm their hearts and show them that we're, you know, nice people to hang around with. This is a step towards them hearing the gospel from us. And if one person on staff had come up with the idea and then said, but this baby's mine, leave me to it, I just want to do it on my own, the rest of us might have breathed a sigh of relief and said, okay, it's yours. And Oktoberfest would be a one-person show. If that had happened, it would be perhaps an excellent little thing, but it would be a little thing, just one person doing it. But in actual fact, the whole staff is taking responsibility for this event, so there's five of us kind of working full bore on it, and so it will be a bigger thing than any one of us could make it to be. But it won't be much bigger if no one signs up to help. And if those of you who have already signed up on the volunteer sheets in the South Foyer change your minds and don't come, and there's just five of us doing what we can, it will be a pale comparison to what it could be if 100 of us or 200 of us take a turn doing this or that or whatever you see it on the sign-up sheet. And that's the idea. We want to show the community in this sort of frivolous and entertaining level what it looks like when a whole group of people work together. One of the ways in which I can incorporate teamwork into my life is by being part of a small group. And I've been a part of a small group here in the church for a long time. There's a early morning prayer meeting that meets here on Thursday mornings. You men are invited. Any Thursday morning will do. And as a team, we work together on the work of prayer. But as a Tuesday night event, I'm part of a cell group, and cell groups here in the church have as their third mandate serving, which means that besides being a study group and a care group, those are the other two mandates, every cell group is a workforce, a work team, and every cell group is obligated to look around at the church family and needs that might be met and the community and projects that might be taken on and do work together. And good things happen in terms of us connecting with one another when we work together. But one of the good things, to state the obvious, is that stuff gets accomplished that wouldn't get accomplished if the team wasn't looking around to find something to do and then throwing their efforts together. So here I am, you know, nearly 50, and I can imagine, if I live that long, getting to 60 and looking back on these 10 years of life. And I think I know something about what being in my 50s will be like. There will be a temptation. There will be an inclination for me to start stepping off of teams. It would be a temptation to say, well, I've done this cell group thing now for quite a while. I think I'll just let it go. It's, cell groups are in good hands. Let somebody else do that. Or I think I've done enough of that accountability and prayer thing. I'll hand it off to some younger fellow and I'll just stay home. I think there is a tendency for people as they get older to consider themselves excused by seniority from various teams. And what I'm seeing is that if I go that way with less teamwork, with less team participation, they'll be less accomplished. And I don't want to be a silly old man. I want to walk as a wise man, not as an unwise man who devoted the rest of his life, the second half of my life if I live to be 100, or the last few years if I get struck down in my prime, to nothing. I don't want to devote my life to silly things. I don't want to be nothing but a jogger and a canoe paddler as much as I love those things. I want to be fully gripping important things right till the time when my life on earth is complete. So the challenge is to accomplish something, and the key is teamwork. I would strongly encourage you, as a person who also wants to live carefully the valuable life that you are living, to get involved and to stay involved on a team where you can be a part of a larger thing than you could be on your own. Let us be careful not to be silly as we get older. Here's the second challenge, and you get to it in the middle, whether you're going 3-2-1 or 1-2-3. Challenge number two from Ephesians is the challenge of loving people. You see it in Ephesians chapter 5. Verses 1 and 2, Paul the Apostle says, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. This is the challenge of loving people. And it's not the only place that Paul calls us to that challenge. Back in chapter 4, when we were considering the subject of church unity a couple of weeks ago, we looked at chapter 4, the first few verses, and although it's a call to unity, it's also a call to this sort of love for people. Paul the Apostle says, "Walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing forbearance to one another in love." Our love must be characterized by patience and humility and forbearance and gentleness if it's going to be effective love at all. And here in Ephesians chapter 5, under the heading of walking, we're told to walk in love by imitating God. Now, to imitate God in our love is not just a matter of loving as he loves, you know, sacrificially as Christ demonstrated, but also loving what he loves. And so the key here, the key to challenge of loving people, is prioritizing. This is a complicated point, and I'm glad to talk to any of you more about it or email any of you more about it. If it sounds wrong, I think it's actually right, but it's complicated right, so it doesn't sound right. Like the concept, in fact, identical to the Old Testament concept that God is a jealous God, that sounds wrong, but of course it's right and it's in the Bible. Here's the deal. To love what God loves as God loves is to love God first. Now, this is a difficult doctrine, and it has to do with the jealousy of God. But here's the deal. God is not only all-loving. God is not only infinitely loving, but he's infinitely righteous. He's the righteous judge. His justice is perfect. And righteousness and justice is a matter of seeing things for what they are and valuing appropriately everything according to its true value. So God in his perfect righteousness must put the highest value on that which is of the highest value. Otherwise he'd be unrighteous in preferring something which was not in actual fact as worthwhile as something else, right? God must value that which is most valuable the most. And he does. And that's why from Genesis to Revelation, you have over and over again in the Bible, God's, you could say, obsession with his own glory and the call for us to do everything we do, whether in word or deed, to the glory of God. And why is it not wrong for God to say, put me first, put me at the center, and live for my glory? It's because of God's perfect righteousness. As the perfectly righteous one, he values that which is most valuable the most. And he is the most valuable of all things. He is the source of all worth. So he centers his understanding of the universe on himself, and he calls us to imitate him in this, not to center ourselves on ourselves, that would be the wrong way to imitate God, but to center our attention and our lives upon him. And here's one of the things that happens when you do that. When you make your love for God your first love, when you love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, the Holy Spirit works in you a great work. He pours the love of God in you and so empowers you to love others supernaturally. And you learn to love as Christ loves. That's what we're commanded to do, right? A new commandment he gives us, that we would love one another as he has loved us. You learn to love as Christ loves by the love of God flowing into you and through you. And you get that love of God pouring into you and through you as you love God supremely. So it's a matter of prioritizing. How can I be and remain a truly loving person? By loving God the most, by prioritizing my relationship with him and working on my love for God the most, and then the love of God poured into my heart by the Holy Spirit given to me will cause me to be a loving person to others, especially to those others who are closest to me. The second commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. Now, I have observed, not only in myself, but in other people, and in the Saturday Color Comics, a guy named Crankshaft, I have noticed a tendency for men as they get older to get cranky. And I don't want to become a cranky old man. Why do old men tend towards crankiness or grumpiness or orneriness? Why is this a tendency? I think it's because they are the angry young men of yesterday. There's something in a young man that tends towards anger. It can be a good thing if it's anger towards moral injustice. It can be a bad thing if it's anger that springs from selfishness. But there's something in a lot of us as young men that just gets really animated when something that we thought was going to go one way goes the other way instead. We get mad when the peg that we're trying to get into the hole turns out not to fit because it's a square peg and it's a round hole and it's supposed to go in here and I don't get it why it doesn't go. And it can be a right thing, you know. We look out into the community and we see some grave injustice and it makes us mad with righteous indignation and we go do something about it. But it's just as likely to be a selfish thing where we thought the evening was going to go this way and it turns out to go that way and that really ticks me off. I miss my program. There's something about a young man that can be angry. And that young man, as he gets older, loses his steam. And the anger starts to taper off, like everything else tapers off. And by the time he's, you know, my age, he doesn't have the steam to get mad anymore. So he settles into this kind of general crankiness. Oh, so many things tick me off. What's the point of getting excited about any of them? So, you know, you face right now as a church family the alarming prospect of having a truly old pastor. I mean, a year from now, all being equal, your pastor will be an old bearded guy in his 50s. And if I don't go away and you don't force me to go away, I could be much older than that before I'm finished here. And does the prospect of me not fighting crankiness appeal to you? Or would you like me to fight the crankiness within me and somehow become more and more loving as I get older? What if I live another 20 years and you gather together at my funeral, whether I'm long gone from the London community or I haven't moved an inch, and you say to each other about me, you know, the older he got, the kinder, the more patient, the more you could just sense the love of God flowing from his heart. This would be good, right? Especially considering the alternatives. Got kind of cranky in his 50s. You don't want that to happen? I don't want that to happen. I should commit myself to it not happening. This is the challenge of loving people. And a key is keeping my priorities straight. If I work on my relationship to God first, the love of God flowing through me will help me in my quest to fight crankiness and be a genuinely kind old man. And then we come to the greatest challenge of all. I think it's the greatest in terms of its most of it being the most important, and it's also greatest in terms of it being the biggest challenge, because it has to do with the inner life, which is harder to tame than the outer life, for a reason that we'll get to. And here's the challenge. Number one, we say it third, but it's the challenge number one, the challenge of good character. It's the challenge that Paul is talking about in Ephesians chapter 4 when he says in verse 17, don't walk as the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind. It's the challenge he's got in mind when he talks about imitating Christ in chapter 5, who was a fragrant aroma to God in his holiness. He goes on in verse 3 to say, don't let immorality or any impurity or greed even be named among you. And verse 12, it's disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by the wicked people in secret. Here's the challenge, to not let the inner life so corrupt itself that as I get older, I get more and more to be a decrepit old, dirty old man. Now, if it's alarming to think of your pastor becoming a cranky old man, it is even more alarming to think of him becoming a man of questionable character. So I have a strong obligation, and you know it, and you have a strong obligation in regard to the important aspects of your life to work on your character and to strive for good character. Paul the Apostle says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8, walk as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what's pleasing to the Lord. And don't participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead, by your life, expose them. For it's disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. Now, what is the key to striving for moral integrity, for attaining some level of moral integrity, and maintaining it through to the end of your earthly life? What's a key? A key I have learned is accountability. It explains why it's harder to work on your character than on your conduct. Because your conduct is more or less seen by people, right? If you go to the wrong places, if you do the wrong things, someone's going to see and make you feel appropriately bad about it. But you can have all kinds of things going on in your life, in your heart, in your mind that are secrets. And no one knows about them, except, of course, that the one to whom we are most accountable, which is God. And it's a strange evidence of how small is our faith that the fact that the eyes of the Lord are in every place beholding the evil and the good slows us down inwardly so little, while if anyone else's eyes were on us, we would be very careful about our lives and our conduct and our behavior, right? So we can do all kinds of things in secret because only God is watching. And evidently we need more accountability than the accountability we have before God. So here's another reason why I should stay in an accountability and prayer group, and another reason why I commit myself to doing so. Another reason why I should stay in a cell group, because there's a measure of accountability that's involved in meeting with people on a regular basis, like a weekly basis, and they say, so, you know, somebody you know says, so how are you doing now? And you've prayed together and you've shared things about your challenges, and so they can ask you that. That's what we do on Thursday mornings. Men are invited to it. Fill out checkup sheets, and we say, here's what I'm going to try to do with the Bible this week. Here's what I'm going to try to do in terms of the spiritual leadership of my household, and I want you to look at my checkup sheet next week and ask me how I did, and if I didn't do anything at all, please give me some sort of verbal swift kick, because I need that, and I could end up wasting a whole lot of time if I don't stay on my game. And speaking of accountability and the fact that our most important accountability is to God himself, let me give a commercial plug that's right in context to all of you men in regard to the men's retreat next weekend. And women, listen up, because there's a women's retreat every June, which is exactly the same thing. Of all the value of the men's retreat every September or October of the year, I think the chief value, certainly for me the chief value, is the 2.5-hour period every Saturday morning, and the women do the same sort of thing at their retreat in June, called the half day in prayer. It's hardly a half day, really. It's 2.5 hours. But it's a time of prayerful, solo meditation. Now, you feel like you're in the brotherhood, you're in the company of other good men, because they're all out all over the camp property in their own places. And I have a path I walk and a tree I stand behind and then another tree I walk to. And this is the 7th annual retreat. So every year now for 7 years, I've had this 2.5-hour time when I evaluate my life prayerfully before God. And although it's just once a year is a pretty small thing, actually, when you get to be my age. And I have a chance to look back at 12 months and say, what was I thinking 12 months ago? What was I trying to be? What habits was I trying to break? What disciplines were I trying to master? What was I all about? And how have I done for these 12 months? And what do I want the next 12 months to be like? And actually, last fall, the men's retreat was interrupted for me by a family wedding in Toronto. I had to skip out for Saturday, and it was a very painful thing to leave because I didn't get to do the 2.5 hours. And it's a very monumental thing. There is something in a man that does not like a man's retreat. Don't quite understand why it is, but we get 80 or 90 women signing up for the women's retreat. There's something about retreats that women look forward to, and men do not, so we get fewer men to that, and I regret the fact that we get fewer men. I don't know if it's, you know, sharing a bathroom with 8 other slobs, or sleeping in the same room where you could hear 8 men snoring as loudly as you do, or what it is, but there's something about the men's retreat that doesn't naturally appeal. So I call you to tap into the supernatural appeal of having this monumental turning point in your life every year. And you can find a path to walk on and a tree to stand beside, and you think about your life, and you pray about it, and you make plans, which you then can be accountable to your brothers in regard to. And this is one of the ways, this practice of accountability is one of the ways in which we can take upon ourselves the necessary challenge of good character. I'm glad to go on record at the age of 49 years old. However long I live, I do not want to be a silly old man. I do not want to be a cranky old man. I do not want to be a dirty old man. And I call you as my church family on whatever levels you're able to help me with this, to encourage me, to challenge me, to rebuke me if you see me slipping in those directions, which I think are very natural to me, which I'm becoming to despise the prospect of more and more. And it won't be easy, because all the natural tendencies are in the opposite direction. If I get to my finish line and I'm actually a man who's accomplished something and a kind person and a person of integrity, there'll be God to thank and he'll get the glory, but it will be true that I worked hard on it, because it's not going to happen without hard work. I need to be careful how I live. Olympic athletes who work hard for 4 years in between the games follow the motto, swifter, higher, stronger. And because they believe that motto, to the degree that they hold to that motto, they accomplish a great thing in sporting, and they win a gold medal. Well, our motto should be similar. We could say purer, kinder, wiser. And Paul the Apostle says they do it to win a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. And those who attain the standard and become purer and kinder and wiser as they live will have a great reward when we stand before the one who enlisted us in the race and who calls us to follow him towards God and all that's before us. So let's pray together and ask God to help us to be careful with this valuable thing that is our life.